accession number 19766, Reel 2.
Les Griffiths, Reel 2. What unit were you with in Birmingham here?
In Brum, the 6th King's Own Royal Regiment. And a holding regiment.
Now, you were just about to tell me about this Jewish child.
Yes, well, we picked up our equipment, our tools, in other words, and we went up at the end of the site, a very open site where we were now told that we were going to learn how to dig trenches. And I looked at my companion next to me, who didn't seem to know how to hold a pick, and who said he'd never done any of this before, and I could tell from the other chaps that they'd never done anything like this before. A pen was probably their main equipment, or something like that. So we got down to digging, and I had been used to it. I was digging away with my pick, and the Jewish chap next to me suddenly sort of gave a small squeal, and I looked at him, and the pick had slid down the shaft and was pinching his finger there, in between his forefinger and thumb. Oh, and he was making such a noise. And I can understand it, because as a boy, it had happened to me in Wales. And I eased it off his hand, and oh, he was in a terrible state. He said, "What am I going to do? I'm a violinist." He said, I was a violinist with Henry Wood. He said, "I'll never play the violin again." "Oh," I said, "you will." And I spit on his fingers, on his hand, and was gently rubbing it in and rubbed it in, probably for 5 minutes until gradually I think the pain had gone away, because it is painful. It's very, very painful. Anyway, we then carried on doing, supposedly digging a trench, making this trench, and that went by. And the following Friday night, or probably a week or so afterwards, they had a camp concert. And Spigot, my companion in the trench, was playing the violin. And he played a piece of music called The Canary. And it was marvellous. It was such a change. We were all sitting there, and there was my... playing the spigot. And I never saw him after that. I don't know what happened to him. He probably ended up in Ensor, or one of the army orchestras. But that was a little cameo, so to speak, there. From there, we did our training. We trained at bayonet practice. Bayonet training, you've seen it on TV, where you grab your rifle and you bayonet, and you go for that sack of straw with Hitler's face on the top of it, and you scream and you shout and you moo, and you tear yourself down the stretch between you and it, and you ram it in and pull it out, and you do the same thing again, and somebody claps and others go ugh, and so that goes on for an hour or so, until you have some other training. And I can always remember one of our sergeants taking us in, shooting at a tank. And he said, "You always, always aim ahead of the tank." And he held his arms up as if he was carrying a rifle. And he held it up. And he was moving along with the edge of the tank. And he hit someone behind the... He hit one of the lads behind the head with his hand. The chap... I can't remember any more than that, but it struck everybody as so funny, because we could all laugh by now. And we thoroughly enjoyed that, because he's a sergeant. After all, if you can't laugh at a sergeant, you can't laugh at anyone, can you, really? So anyway, we carried on there for 3 months, during which time we came soldiers, so supposedly. And then we were moved from there to the coast. And we moved to this particular part of the coast where, and it still happens today, I believe, where the coast falls in, erosion. And we were looking, we were marched along behind this barbed wire, massive coils of danite wire. And we looked down and there were three coils already down there where the cliff had eroded to such an extent that they fell over. So this, the one we were behind would be the next, of course. And that night, we used to march up and down there in pairs. Looking up, we were told, look out to sea. Now, the thing about looking out to sea is something which you never dreamed of until it happens to you. You look out to sea and the sea seems to be looking back at you. And after 4 or 5 minutes, you swear that the sea has spotted you and it's coming for you. And it seems to rise and rise and rise, and you have to shake your head and look away. And you have to do that because the sea appears, although it's down there. It's down at the bottom of a cliff and out. It appears to be coming at you.
This was on the Yorkshire coast.
On the Yorkshire
coast. Whereabouts on the Yorkshire coast?
I'm trying to think where the place was.
It wasn't a place called Hornsea, was it?
It is around the Hornsea. Hornsea was one of the places, I'm sure.
Withernsea?
We were at Withernsea. Oh, the winter of 1940 was a shocker. Yes, Withernsea was one. Withernsea, we were told, was the farthermost place which stuck out into the east, into the Northeast Sea, was that right? The North Sea, Withernsea.
Well, I come from around there, and that is the Holderness Coast. And Withernsea.
Well, that was the area from Withernsea up. Withernsea. And then we pulled back into Withernsea, and we used to do guards from the pier. Was that a pier there?
Yes.
Or a jetting out place. And there was a kiosk, which was our guard room, about as big as the little corner of this room. And we would go in there when we were not on duty. And one night I remember it was a terrible winter, 1940. And it was snowing like the clappers, and it used to come through the roof. So our blankets were sodden anyway with the water from the snow. And when we were relieved the following morning, we went to the local hospital with our blankets to be dried out. So that was Withernsea. But I don't remember very much about it.
Which unit were you with there?
Still the 6th King's Own. The 6th King's Own, yes. But now we were, I suppose, nearly soldiers, so to speak. And then we moved to York, where we were stationed, but you must say this very quietly, because really, we always understood it wasn't allowed for troops to be in a church building. It's against the rules. So we were in a church hall, the whole battalion of us. We were stationed in a church hall next to the church. And we started a band there. Joey Burns sent home for his accordion. I can't remember the names of the other lads. I've forgotten their names. But there were about five. I sent home for my drums because I used to have a kit of drums here. Yeah, I had a kit of drums. I sent home for my drums. And we had about a five-piece band. We used to knock up in there. And that gave a quite a fillip to things in general, you know. And then from there we moved to Cheddar. We moved down to Cheddar. And we thought, this is a miserable place. Dead as a doornail, we thought. But it wasn't a bit like that. Once you got to know where things were, and you got to nod to people, you realise there was a lot more went on in a small village than you ever realised before. And we thoroughly enjoyed Cheddar. I'm after to cut this short, otherwise you'll be here for a fortnight.
Don't miss anything interesting out, please.
So we went into Weston-super-Mare occasionally from there, where I learned to do the crawl. I was always a reasonably good swimmer, but I could never do the crawl. But they had a swimming pool on the beach there. And I went to the swimming pool whenever I could, and I learned to crawl. And that to me was really something. I could now do what some of these other tough chaps could do. Anyway, from there, from Cheddar, I think I was getting a little bit tired. We moved from Cheddar to Penzance, which was one of the, once again, like the North Coast, which was always, they always thought might be a place for an attack. Penzance was another place where they thought there might be an attack because of the flat beach, that sort of thing. Where we built up, what do you call the metalwork which they put outside buildings?
Scaffolding.
We scaffolded the whole beach, scaffolded and sandbagged. And that was what we went down there to do, it seemed to me, because that's all we were doing, was scaffolding and sandbagging the beach at Penzance to stop the invasion. So we had the band. The band was going. We'd be playing at dances every now and then. Until I got a letter from my mother to tell me that Harry, my cousin, who was in the Gloucester Regiment. He was going abroad with his battalion. So that was Harry, my best pal, who was with me on holiday. And then I had another letter a little while afterwards telling me that my best pal at work, my foreman, in other words, at work, he was with the RAF, and he was going to Ceylon or somewhere. He was going abroad. And I felt, I know it doesn't sound right in a sense, but I felt somehow a little bit guilty. It was me playing in a dance band, jogging around the country. And I really felt I had to do something about it. And they put up a notice in the company office, on the company office notice board one morning, for volunteers for overseas. And I was the first on the list. So I must tell you this a little bit, to go back to Cheddar for a moment. We were stationed above a shop. We were on the floor above the shop, and the shop was the Cheddar Cheese Taster's shop, Mr. Small, and he was a grand old boy. But he had no cheese then. The shop was empty, and he was just wandering about doing his garden. And occasionally, I used to go down and help him in the garden, because I was in that line. So one day he said to us who were upstairs, he said, would you like to come down to have dinner with me next Sunday? And we wondered where he got his dinner from, quite frankly. But we didn't like to say no, so we said yes, we would. So we duly traipsed down into his kitchen, where he produced a meal of sausages and pickled onions. And I hated onions. I couldn't stand onions all my life. But he was a nice old chap, was Mr. Small. And I had these, I don't know how many sausages per plate, I can't remember. But I didn't like to offend him, so I put some onions on my plate. And I ate them. And I've been eating pickled onions ever since. Now, I won't touch any other sort of onion, but I like a pickled onion. So I thank Mr. Small for that. Wherever you are, you're a grand old boy. Strange how things happen, isn't it? Anyway, I put my name down as a volunteer. And came the day, they said, what are we going to do with your drums? Well, I don't know what you're going to do with them. So they paid me for them, the chap who run that sort of thing. They gave me some money for my drum kit, and that was the last I saw of that. So we entrained one morning.
Who's we?
The rest of the volunteers, because I wasn't the only one. There weren't very many, probably a dozen or so. Fred, my pal, who joined up the same day as me from Plymouth, he went and volunteered because I volunteered, and he was a man with two children who'd been bombed out twice from Plymouth. I said, "You a fool, what do you want to do that for?" He put me off, so he put his name down, that's all there was to it. If you're going, I'm going. So we were sent on leave. So I came up to Wembley to my mother. Fred went to Plymouth. And on the way back, we stopped at Plymouth, picked up Fred, and his wife was there carrying a baby. So she said, "Oh, Les, you will look after him, won't you?" I said, "Oh, words to that effect. Silly now. It sounds silly now." I said, "Who's going to look after me?" But that sort of thing happened. So we got on the train, went back down to Penzance overnight, and then got on the train for somewhere. We never knew where we were going. And we ended up back on the northeast coast in pouring rain. Now, what was the name of that place? In pouring rain.
In Yorkshire? Or Northumberland?
Yorkshire coast.
Bridlington?
Scarborough? Just south of Ashington.
Oh, that's Northumberland.
Well, that's what it was. South of Ashington, because Ashington wasn't very far away. And we got off the train onto a coach, and off the coach into this little village. It was pitch dark, of course. Everything was blacked out. And we were sort of taken along this road. And the officer said, or the sergeant said, "You two in there." So we pushed open a door. And there was a room there with dull candlelight and chaps flying all around the walls. And underneath the notice board was a space. And the sergeant said, "You two'd better get there." So everybody's army boots nearly trod on us to death throughout the night as they came in from wherever they were. So that was, I nearly had the name of the place, but it's gone. One thing I do remember was this tiny little cafe in this village. And he used to entertain us by playing the mouth organ through his nose. I'd never seen that before. But Newbiggin. That was the name of the place, Newbiggin. There were lumps of coal on the beach. And came the day when...
What unit were you with now?
Now we're joined... Oh, this was the Border Regiment.
The 9th Borders.
The 9th Borders. We had finally made it to some other regiment. We didn't know what they were, of course, till we got there. The 9th Border Regiment. And it was cold. It was winter. It was bitter. And we used to have to go out into the open to wash and shave. And we used to swear about the officers having the time of their lives doing their ablutions. So we thought. All soldiers thought that way, that those people were different. They had everything, we had nothing, you know, that sort of attitude. Anyway, we trained there and we did some more bayonet charging and all the rest of it. We did shooting and everything else. And came the day when we had to get new clothes because we were going overseas. We didn't know where we were going, of course. Nobody knew where we were going except the villagers. They all knew where we were going. We were going to Iceland, according to them. So we were issued out with topies and KDs. And what else were we issued with? Long johns. Oh, right, long johns. We all had long johns. Well, I'd never worn long johns in my life, but my brother did, because he used to climb ladders. So we all looked at one another with these long johns, those of us who didn't know, never worn them, and we all sent them home to our relations, these long johns, and there was never a word said. So don't blame me if the war went on a little longer. So what, where was I? Oh yes, the villagers knew we were going to the Iceland, so we were issued out with tropical kits, and we marched up and down with our tropical kit. And then came the day when we moved from Newbiggin, got on our coaches, up to Scotland, to the Clyde. I can't remember the actual spot on the Clyde, but to the Clyde. And we saw this beautiful ship ahead of us as we marched along the... marched along towards the ship. And it was called the Orcades. Brand new, so we were told. Brand new ship on its maiden voyage. So up we went with our kit on our back, rifles, kit bags, everything else, up the gangplank, onto the boat. Come along now, said the various sergeants. So there were plenty of sergeants around who ushered us through. And we passed lots of likely-looking cabins. We thought, this is all right. So we enjoyed this. And then, come along now, you blokes in the front, downstairs. And this kept going downstairs, and we kept going downstairs, and we kept going downstairs, until in the end we forgot about the cabins. And we realised that we were below the waterline. We couldn't go any farther. That was it. And we were in this great big space. All that was there were tables, and at the ends of the space were masses of hammocks, all looking at you, end on, looking like rolls of jam rolls, looking like jam rolls. So we were milling about in there, and the sergeants got to us and said, "Now find your spaces wherever you want." So we all put up hammocks, and we all jumped in, and most of us fell out again. So I ended up sleeping on the table. I wasn't going to have that anymore. So there was a table. There was nothing on it except our kit. So I slept on a table. Fred slept under the table, and we didn't sleep in a hammock anymore because so many people fell out of them that those that could hang on did, and those that couldn't didn't. That's the way it was. But we all rolled up our hammock every morning as per ship's captain's orders. And he used to come down, Captain Fox, very smart, dapper man. And he used to look around, and he was always satisfied with the appearance of the place. But we were about six decks down or more. And when we went up for breakfast, we used to make noises like sheep would, you know, like bear, that sort of thing, as we were going up the stairs to wherever the food was, the breakfast or whatever the meal was, until we got fed up with that, of course. But
why make a noise like a sheep?
Well, we felt we were like sheep, you know, we were sheep down there. We were ushered into places, masses of us. We were all in there, the whole battalion. And there were, I remember there was one chap whose name, if I'd remember, I wouldn't mention it, but I can't remember his name anyway. He wouldn't wash. So there was a bit of a scuffle at one end, and he was being pushed along to the ablutions where he was washed by some of the lads. And then there was a sergeant who took the puggri. Do you know what a puggri is?
Yes.
It's the band on a bush hat, on a hat. On his topi, rather, on a topi. He took the band off his topi and scrubbed it. And we thought, oh dear, are we all going to have to do that now? But we didn't, somehow or other. He was the only one to scrub his puggri. So that's another little incident. But all sorts of things happened on the boat. I'd been to Africa as a boy, so I knew a little bit about sunshine, so I didn't get sunburned, but by golly, some of the chaps did. They were roasted to death eventually when hitting the tropics. There were all sorts of games on the ship. Around the corner, you'd find gambling going on and that sort of thing, money changing hands, various games of that sort, and you got bored stiff. You watched the fish in the sea, the occasional Whale and so on. And an idea struck me. I hope you've got enough tapes, because I haven't started yet. An idea struck me that I wonder where we're going. Could it be to South Africa, I wonder? Is it possible, I wonder, to contact my father? He lived in Johannesburg. So the idea got stronger in my mind. So I spoke to Smudge and Fred, and they said, don't talk so damn silly. Of course, you'll never be able to see your father. So I went to one of our officers. He said the same thing. So from our officer, I went to our CO, who said the same thing. So I wasn't going to be beaten. You must remember that when a man is drawn into the forces, he becomes a different sort of man. He's away from his home and his mother's apron strings, or his wife's apron strings in some cases. So he's different. And I must have been a bit of a cheeky one somehow. I must have had something which I didn't think I had. So I went from one officer to another until I ended up in the ship's command office. He was the man who run the ship from the soldier's angle. A big man, big jovial man, who said, come in, when somebody had ushered me into a small room. And he said, what's your trouble, lad? And I said, I told him the story. I said, I have a father who lives in South Africa, Johannesburg. I said, I just wondered if we were going that way, would it be possible? That sounds silly to me now, but it's what I'm saying, that I could possibly get a message to him in some way or another. He said, hopeless, he said. There are so many factions in South Africa. The Boers are still anti-British, and there are more Boers than there are anyone else in South Africa. He was a nice chap. They were all very, very nice about this. They thought I was, probably thought I was a little bit gone, you know, with the sunshine or something. But he said, no, how do the questions? So that was all there was to it. Until one day we pulled in at Freetown. And we pulled into the river, what they called the river, the big estuary, right in the middle of the river, to keep away from the mosquitoes, which Freetown would be filled with. And we used to watch the kids coming out in their boats, and we'd be throwing them coins, and they'd be diving for them, and all that sort of thing. And one day I was leaning over the side, and I felt awful. I suddenly felt bad, ill. And Fred, some of the boys, what's the matter, Taff? I said, I don't know, I feel awful. So he said, come inside. So it took me inside. Oh, I was beginning to sweat. Oh, sweating. So they took me down the stairs, get me cooler and cooler, or warmer and warmer, whatever it was. And I was sitting there, and then I fainted. And the next thing I knew, I was in the sick bay. And I didn't know what had happened. But a mosquito had come out, special for me, from the land, looking for me, found me, and jabbed me. And I had malaria. Although I didn't know about this until 5 days afterwards. I'd been in there, or 3 days afterwards it was. And one morning, I was lying in this bed with its sides up. And four or five heads appeared above me. And they all looked down on me, and one pricked my ear, another got hold of my thumb, and one of them said to the others, yes, I think he's got it. And I wondered what I'd got, because all I could see were these heads looking.